From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. A ruling by the Permanent Court of Arbitration at The Hague found in favor of the Philippines in a case brought against China over disputes between the two in the South China Sea. The Hague Tribunal ruled that China had caused irreparable harm to the ecosystem of the Spratly Islands and breached the Philippines' sovereign rights. Beijing had repeatedly said it did not recognize the jurisdiction of The Hague's arbitration court and boycotted the hearings. China's foreign ministry said it will ignore the ruling, saying that China has exercised control of the islands for 2,000 years. Nevertheless, the court said in its 497-page ruling that there was no legal basis for China to claim historic rights to resources within the sea areas falling within the so-called Nine-Dash Line, a demarcation line on a map of the sea made in 1947. In a statement issued after the ruling, China's foreign ministry said it, quote, solemnly declares that the award is null and void and has no binding force. China neither accepts nor recognizes it, closed quote, adding, quote, China's territorial sovereignty and maritime rights and interests in the South China Sea shall under no circumstances be affected by those awards. China opposes and will never accept any claim or action based on those awards, closed quote. Taiwan also issued a statement that it does not accept the tribunal's ruling, insisting on its sovereignty over South China Sea islands. The dispute over the South China Sea involves the Spratly and Paracel Islands. Beijing's territorial claims partly overlap those of the Philippines, Vietnam, and Taiwan, while Beijing also has ongoing disputes in the area with Malaysia and Brunei. Beijing has called Washington's involvement in the dispute the greatest threat to the region, accusing the U.S. of putting on a show of force by increasing its military strength and that of its allies in the region. The U.S. Navy has deployed additional warships in the disputed zone, conducting maneuvers near China's islands and flying over them, claiming it was all in the interests of freedom of navigation. China's rejection of the jurisdiction of the Hague panel is shared by former Philippines diplomat and Secretary General of the Maritime and Oceans Affairs Center, Alberto Encomienda.
I think that is an artificially recourse by the Philippines to insist on first sovereign rights and not sovereignty. But will it really solve anything? I don't think so. As we tried to strengthen our control of the islands, we were the first to build an airfield there. We were among the claimant countries, not only China, but among the five claimant countries, the Philippines was the first to build an airfield.
Among the peaceful projects being developed by China in the South China Sea is a tsunami early warning system, as CCTV's Gu Wingfei reports.
The tsunami, perhaps the most destructive oceanic force on Earth. In 2011, a giant tsunami hit Japan and more than 18,000 people were confirmed dead or missing in the catastrophe. 1 month later, China's State Oceanic Administration called for the building of a tsunami early warning system in the South China Sea. This is the latest Chinese tsunami monitoring buoy. Each one is equipped with solar panels and one of China's Beidou navigation devices. The largest one can be up to 56 tons. Staff took us inside the buoy to have a closer look.
This is a buoy data collecting system. Our readings of water levels, temperatures, and sea depth can be synchronized via satellite in the control room at headquarters.
China has built a monitoring network with two deployment locations on the South China Sea. The data the network detects can be simultaneously read in these charts.
This region in the South China Sea is where the Manila Trench is located. The drastic change in the seabed will lead to a possibility of earthquake formation. And an earthquake of a more than 7 magnitude will increase the possibility of a tsunami formation, and if a tsunami happens here, and you can see that the buoys on the sea will detect the waves and send back the data back to the South China Sea Prediction Center, and analysts here will use tsunami model to give a report about future risks.
Bai Yiping is the deputy director of the South China Sea Prediction Center. He told me each buoy costs 60 million yuan and his center can evaluate a tsunami within a minute.
The government is investing a lot more in building a tsunami warning system, so our tsunami research is getting better and better. Now we can finish calculating the early warning in minutes or even in 30 seconds.
And yet the tsunami wave travels slower than an earthquake wave, so the center adopts a two-track system to issue a tsunami early warning.
If an earthquake happens, firstly, according to the information we receive from the State Seismological Bureau, we issue our first early warning. Then in 30 minutes, the wave will reach the location of the buoys. After analyzing the wave data, we'll keep updating the prediction reports.
Jiang says this early warning system does not only serve China, but also provides warning services for neighboring countries in the region. But to provide more accurate predictions, more buoys along with more international cooperation are needed. Gu Yingfei, CCTV, Guangzhou, Guangdong Province.
A new prime minister for the UK who says Brexit means Brexit.
I am honoured and humbled to have been chosen by the Conservative Party to become its leader.
That was the new leader of the UK's Conservative Party, Theresa May, as she pledged to make the country's departure from the EU a success when she takes over as Prime Minister later this week.
During this campaign, my case has been based on three things. First, the need for strong, proven leadership to steer us through what will be difficult and uncertain economic and political times. The need, of course, to negotiate the best deal for Britain in leaving the EU and to forge a new role for ourselves in the world. Brexit means Brexit, and we're going to make a success of it.
May made the comments outside Parliament shortly after Andrea Leadsom, her only rival for the Conservative Party's leadership, withdrew on Monday. May will replace the outgoing Prime Minister David Cameron Wednesday, and she thanked him for leading the Tories and the country after Cameron had announced earlier in the day that he would step down on Wednesday. The outgoing Prime Minister described May as strong and competent. Cameron has been Prime Minister since 2010 and announced he would quit after the Brexit vote last month. Angry protests continue in Bahrain for the 22nd consecutive day over the regime's revocation of the citizenship of a top Shia clerk, Sheikh Isa Qassim. Press TV's Kanish Fatima has more.
Protesters gathered outside the residence of Sheikh Qassem in the town of Deraz, chanting slogans against the Al-Khalifa regime. Last month, Manama revoked the cleric's nationality, accusing him of inciting violence against the regime. The prominent cleric has categorically denied the allegation. Bahrain's move drew condemnation from across the world. The Al-Khalifa regime is also criticized over its violent crackdown on voices of dissent and incarceration of opposition figures, including Sheikh Ali Salman and Nabil Rajab. Joining us via Skype from London is Shabir Hassan Ali. He's an activist and Islamic scholar. Many thanks for joining us here on Press TV, Mr. Hassan Ali. Now, first of all, as we've just mentioned, 22 days of consecutive protests against the revocation of Sheikh Isa Qassem's citizenship. What do you make of that?
I think it's vindication for the position of Sheikh Isa Qassem within Bahrain society. And it would be intelligent of the Bahraini authorities to take heed of what's actually happening. The fact that they have rescinded the nationality of Sheikh Isa and people have not just capitulated and fallen down and said, oh, okay, you know, khalas, it's over. They have stood firm through even the days of Shah Ramadan, which are difficult anyway, because of the heat and the fasting, and even beyond. And even I remember they did the Eid prayers outside. They are staying by, they're standing firm with Sheikh Isa Qassem. And one of the things that we have to understand that what the Bahraini regime is doing is out of weakness. It's blaming Sheikh Isa Qassem for creating sectarian strife and all of this stuff, when it's well known that the ideology and the political and spiritual ideology that is followed by the Bahraini regime stems from Wahhabism, which is by design, a takfirist ideology where they do create strife. They declare other Muslims to be non-Muslim. This is one of the tenets of what they believe. And so this, you know, for the Bahraini regime to turn around and say that, oh, Sheikh Isa Qasim is creating violence and inciting, creating sectarian strife and all of this stuff, this is, first of all, anyone with half a brain knows that this is false. And secondly, it's indicative that the Bahraini regime actually have no reason, no valid legal reason for removing his nationality.
Well, that brings me to my next question, Mr. Hassan Ali. Has the Bahraini regime miscalculated by this move, by the revocation of Sheikh Isa Qasim's citizenship? What was it hoping to achieve?
I think one of what it's trying to do is they want to either incarcerate or expel, because ultimately removing someone's nationality will ultimately lead to expulsion. They want to try and remove all of the leadership, and they feel that if they remove all of the leadership, then the whole movement for the human rights of the Bahraini people, for the legitimate human rights of the Bahraini people, the peaceful protests, these will all die out, and the people will just go back to their little holes and carry on. This is again, it's a fundamental miscalculation. It shows a lack of insight on the side of the Bahraini regime and those people advising it on how Bahrain is. The people are not rising up just because they're bored and it's a Sunday. They're rising up because for generations, since the inception of this illegitimate monarchy, you have had the indigenous people of Bahrain being treated like garbage. It's not dissimilar, and this is a very important point, it's not dissimilar to what the Zionists are doing in Palestine to the Palestinians who live in 1948 Palestine. And it's not dissimilar to what the American Empire and the American authorities are doing to the African people, the American African people in America. They want to try and subdue them. They want to try and break them. Because again, you have to understand, the ruling elite feel that they have a natural right to rule. And when someone comes along and says, excuse me, look, you know, I have some rights, I need my rights, and they do it peacefully, the first target is the leadership, the elite of that particular community. Because the understanding is, the traditional understanding has been, you remove the elite, the group falls into disarray, everything falls apart at the seams. I believe this is not going to be the case. We have seen time and time again, the people now are organized, they understand what's going on. The only thing that will happen, and the Bahraini authorities should understand this, if they've got advisors advising them to the contrary, they need to fire those advisors and get better advisors. Because the only thing they're going to achieve right now, if they do anything to Sheikh Isa Qasim, like if they expel him, or worse, God forbid, then they will have removed the last obstacle, the last person who was pushing for peaceful resistance.
The ruling that we reported earlier by the Permanent Court of Arbitration at The Hague in favor of the Philippines and against China's claims in the South China Sea came days after NATO held a summit in Warsaw, the capital of Poland, and the site where the Warsaw Pact Agreement, which created an alliance between East European countries and the USSR, was signed in the 1950s. For more on that, we spoke with Dmitry Babich from Radio Sputnik, based in Moscow, via Skype Tuesday.
To me, it was unexpected because we have been waiting for the decision of the Hague Tribunal for 2 years. Let me remind you that initially, the Philippines, they presented their case to the Hague in 2013. When you wait for something for 2 years, you expect some kind of a good product. And the ruling by the Hague Tribunal was absolutely monstrous, because the mere idea that some people in the middle of Poland can decide matters in the South China Sea is ludicrous. This tribunal has very bad reputation in Russia, because these are the same people who 2 years ago passed a ruling ordering Russia to pay $50 billion to the former owners of the Yukos company, you know, the company that failed to pay its taxes to the Russian budget for many years and as a result went bankrupt. So you know, that same Hague Tribunal passed a decision which is unprecedented, you know, to pay $50 billion. Even for such a big nation as Russia, this would be, you know, simply untenable. So now the same tribunal passed its ruling on South China Sea, saying that China had no right to be present there militarily. China had no right to build an island on the coral reefs. And of course, China simply ignored this decision. And it comes at a very bad time for the West, because in 2 days, China will be visited by a delegation from the European Union asking for investment and loans. And you can easily guess how these people will be received in Beijing after the so-called arbitration in one of the EU member countries passed such a ruling on China.
Yeah, it sort of echoes in like the 17th century or something, with, you know, some masters in Europe deciding who owns what in Asia.
You're exactly right. And it's interesting that the Philippines, they wouldn't go to Holland without so-called advice from the United States. It was the United States that urged, you know, the Filipinos to go to The Hague. And quite unexpectedly, you know, the tribunal in Hague passed the decision that the United States wanted them to pass, because we all know that the United States wants to pressure China on these so-called islands, you know, actually, you know, islands built by China near the South China Sea. And the idea that people in Holland might know the situation in South China Sea better than the Chinese themselves, the idea that they can rule all these things is simply ludicrous.
And China doesn't recognize the jurisdiction over it in this case anyway, given the fact that their claims that are being made sound in the sovereignty issues rather than in maritime issues, and consequently are outside the jurisdiction of this particular arbitration board.
Well, the problem is that the so-called international justice has been hijacked by the United States and the European Union long ago. We see some very strange actions and some very strange inactions from the international justice. You know, just recently, a British investigative commission found out that Tony Blair started the war against Iraq illegally, you know, that it was based on flawed intelligence, and it was done for artificial reasons. I'm quoting the report. So you would expect The Hague to take Mr. Blair to justice. Nothing like that happens. And, you know, the number one criminal, George Bush Jr., who actually masterminded the attack, doesn't pay any attention to what's happening in Britain. The State Department has no comment on the rulings of the Sir John Chilcot's Commission on the Iraqi War. And Mr. Bush continues to give lectures for hundreds of thousands of dollars. So here we have a situation when international justice is simply hijacked by the United States and by its allies.
And this treaty, of course, that establishes the tribunal in the first place was not endorsed by the U.S. Senate, and consequently is not effective as against the United States. The U.S. itself doesn't recognize its jurisdiction over the U.S., like the International Criminal Court, for example, where Bush would go since the U.S. never signed the Rome Treaty.
Well, the number of cases when the United States went against the international court rulings, you know, this number continues to swell. For some reason, the American government continues to claim that it had UN mandate to bomb Libya, which is simply not true, because if you read that Security Council resolution, it specifically prohibits supplies of foreign armaments to Libya. And we not only had armaments, we had special forces from Britain and France going into the country. In the same way, the war in Yugoslavia was not sanctioned by the United Nations. So from a legal point of view, it was a crime. And we have many other such cases, but somehow now the culprit is brought to justice.
And, you know, to accentuate the point, there was a the head of the U.S. Defense Department, I believe, Ashton Carter, standing on board a ship in the South China Sea, saying essentially that China was somehow militarizing the South China Sea. And you had a similar absurdity in terms of imagery taking place in Warsaw with NATO talking about the threat of expansionist Russia at the very place where the Warsaw Pact, which no longer exists, was signed.
Well, I think it was very important for the revanchist circles in Poland and in other European countries. It was important for them to have, you know, this new NATO summit taking place at the same location at the presidential palace in Warsaw, where the Warsaw Treaty had been signed back in 1955. You know, it's like Hitler, who absolutely wanted France's capitulation to be signed at the same train car where World War I was ended by a peace treaty in 1919. So these are the same kind of feelings, you know, that prompt such actions. It's interesting that when NATO claims that, you know, it is the guarantor of peace in Europe, peace in Europe existed when the Warsaw Treaty was active, between 1955 and 1989. Europe didn't see major wars then, in that period. If we look at, you know, the period when NATO operated in Europe alone, which started from 1990, we immediately had wars. We had a war in Bosnia, we had a war in Croatia, we had a war in Kosovo. And there are now more women wars, you know, we now have war in Ukraine. So it's a big question, who was the grant of peace in Europe? And of course, it's ludicrous to claim that Russia is expansionist. It's enough to look at the maps of the Soviet Union and its allies and of NATO in 1990, and at the map of NATO and Russia today. Then you will clearly see who expanded and how.
Yeah, I mean, the idea of expansion is an absurdity when you consider that the reason that NATO now touches Russia's borders isn't that Russia has expanded to NATO, but NATO has expanded to Russia. What's the view in Moscow of this and of the military exercises that have been going on?
Well, the view, of course, is very negative. Even the people who are usually expressing pro-Western views, you know, the so-called liberals, they are simply silent now because it's impossible to ignore the aggressive nature of, you know, the summit in Warsaw. And the problem is that the United States and Canada, they are doing everything to make any possible conflict there global. So basically what NATO has been doing during that summit was to put sacks of explosives around what they believe to be a fire, you know. Why they just believe it to be a fire, I will explain, because Russia has no intention of invading the Baltic countries or Poland. It's all an invention of the American and the European media. There were no border skirmishes, there were no dangerous troop movements, this is simply invented. But still, they are going to put 1,000 American troops in Poland, they're going to put Canadian troops in Lithuania, they're going to put British troops in Estonia, right next to St. Petersburg. So they believe it to be a fire and they put sacks of explosives around it, although there is no fire. But if there is a fire, any conflict in that area will immediately become global because they did everything to make it possible.
So, you know, looking at it from the point of view of the Russian defense ministers, whenever there's these massive drills, troop movements and material being moved up to Russia's borders, it looks exactly like an invasion from the point of view of preparing a defense. What kind of defensive moves are they making?
Well, the Russian defense minister, Sergei Shoigu, said that Russia would have three divisions defending its Western Front. It is not very often mentioned in the West, but Russia has been basically gradually dismantling its infrastructure, you know, from the Soviet times, which was used to defend Russia from a possible attack from the West. So Russia also has to rebuild defenses on that direction, in that area. But of course, Russian army is no match compared to the Western armies in terms of resources, in terms of financing. Even the number of people is much bigger on the Western side. So Russia's, I think Russia's strategy is just to hope that a real war between NATO and Russia is an impossibility. Because if we don't hope that it is an impossibility, then we are in a very bad position.
And of course, then that leaves Russia no alternative but to use nuclear weapons to defend itself from an attack.
A very strange comment was made. You know, there is an internet portal called EU Observer. It's actually a mouthpiece of the European Union. So that EU Observer published a story 3 days ago, quoting a high-placed NATO official who said that NATO is prepared for an armed conflict with Russia, including a possible nuclear conflict, end of quote. So if someone is pondering the possibility of a nuclear conflict, it's not Russia, it's the West.
And, of course, that spells bad news for just about everyone. Looking at the broad front from the Baltics to the Korean Peninsula, the U.S. seems to be preparing for a war against both Russia and China. And Russia and China did acknowledge at least that they have a strategic alliance of necessity. Recently, both President Xi and President Putin more or less invoking the term. What kind of a strategy do you think they can employ to avoid a war?
Well, I think right now the strategy is to appeal to the common sense of Mr. Obama and the other Western leaders. I mean, after all, Russia has been developing ties to Western nations for the last 30 years. In China, you know, Putin's children studied abroad. In China, the daughter of President Xi Jinping, she also went to the United States to study. It looked like any kind of real conflict would be an impossibility. So I don't think that Russia or China had old plans of having a conflict with the United States. They are probably just elaborating these plans now. But of course, you're right. An alliance between China and Russia looked like an impossibility just 3 years ago. But the events took such a dramatic turn and the misunderstanding with the West is so bad that now you actually see a Sino-Russian alliance forming, and not only in the military terms, but also in the economy. You know, the Chinese agreed to pay higher prices for the Russian natural gas, and the amount of possible Chinese investment in Russia is about $100 billion. China is going to help us build a fast railway line connecting Moscow and Kazan, you know, the capital of Tatarstan. There are many other infrastructure investment projects. And if things continue to go so bad between Russia, between China and the European Union, maybe China will redirect part of the investment that it planned for the European Union to Russia. The EU will only itself to blame because the decision by the court in The Hague was simply absurd. You know, the idea that the court in a country which is a member of the European Union could decide something on what happens in South China Sea, that idea is simply ludicrous.
And if China does redirect that investment, of course, there's negative economic consequences for the EU. This comes at the same time that Jens Stoltenberg, the Secretary General of NATO, was calling for a deeper or an expansion of spending on NATO by the European countries while they're suffering from austerity.
Well, the EU's actions are even more absurd than the actions of the United States. The idea that the European Union and NATO would come up with a joint statement looked like a bad taste just a year ago, and now they came up with that statement in Warsaw, even though for many years they stressed the fact that the EU does not equal NATO. The EU presented itself as a very peaceful, very moderate, pacifist organization, while NATO was a military alliance. Now we see that this is actually the same song.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.